This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
It's a testimony that all those who are not willing to surrender are going to face our forces of law and order.
That was Chamberlain Antua Ndong, a government official in Cameroon, on displaying the corpse of a separatist leader in towns and villages to deter the rebels and warn youth against joining their cause. Details coming up. Also, officials say at least 12 people have died in Sudan's western Darfur region when seasonal torrential rains spawned flash floods. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. Somalian authorities say an aircraft carrying 36 passengers and crew crashed at Mogadishu Airport Monday, but all on board survived. Mohamed Dessein reports from Mogadishu, Somali.
The Juba Airways plane was carrying civilian passengers from the southwestern city of Baidoa when it crashed at Mogadishu's Adenade International Airport on Monday. Ahmed Mualim, Somalia's civil aviation director, who spoke to VOA by phone, said the plane crashed around 11 a.m. local time while landing at the airport. According to eyewitnesses at the airport, the plane descended too early before the runway, flipped upon the touch on the ground, and landed upside down. Witnesses told VOA that the plane caught on fire and saw firefighters battling to put out the flames. Despite the crash and the fire, Mualim says all that 6 people on board survived the crash and that only 3 people sustained minor injuries. Authorities have not determined why the plane crashed. Mohamed Dyson for VOA News, Mogadishu, Somalia.
Police fired tear gas in Sudan's capital Khartoum yesterday to disperse hundreds of anti-coup protesters who also called attention to increasingly deadly tribal clashes in the country's south. The capital has been the scene of nearly weekly protests since Army Chief General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan launched a power grab last October that derailed the transition to civilian rule. The coup saw key international donors pull the plug on funding, exacerbating a long-running economic crisis and feeding into intercommunal unrest in remote parts of the country. Blue Nile State, bordering Ethiopia, is the latest crucible of tribal clashes, and authorities raised the death toll there to 60 from 33 the previous day. Sudanese military authorities in Khartoum have deployed troops to the area to strengthen the security situation and de-escalate tensions. The clashes in Blue Nile State between the Berti and the Hausa tribes first erupted last Monday. Early this month, General Burhan vowed a surprise move to make way for a civilian government, but the country's main civilian umbrella group rejected his move as a ruse, and protesters have continued to press the army chief to resign. Officials say at least 12 people have died in Sudan's western Darfur region when seasonal torrential rains spawned flash floods and damaged or destroyed more than 100 houses in an area inhabited by displaced people. Heavy rain started late Friday at the Kass locality in South Darfur province, according to the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs. Sudan's rainy season usually lasts to September. Last year, flooding and heavy rains killed more than 80 people and inundated tens of thousands of houses across the country. Cameroonian authorities have been displaying the corpse of a separatist leader in towns and villages to deter the rebels and warn youth against joining their cause. Cameroon's military says last week it killed Lekaki Oliver, who was wanted for working with rebel groups in neighboring Nigeria to kill civilians, commit beheadings, and burn hundreds of public buildings. Mokedwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé, Cameroon.
Agriculture Minister Gabriel Mbairobe says floods and elephants have devastated several hundred hectares of farmland, poultry farms and crops, and killed an unknown number of cattle, sheep and goats within the past 6 months.
Il y a eu des attaques de chenilles légionnaires qui ont dévasté les récoltes.
Mbairobe also says devastating migratory caterpillars, crickets and weaver birds have disseminated thousands of hectares of farmland in Cameroon, especially on the border with Chad and Nigeria. He says close to 300,000 people find themselves in extreme or emergency food insufficiency situations, and 2.6 million people are not certain they will have a meal each day. He says food insecurity is threatening the lives of 6 million Cameroonians. Speaking in Yaoundé on Monday during a crisis meeting, Mbairobe said most poor civilians threatened by food insecurity find it difficult to cope with rising prices caused by Russia's war in Ukraine. The Cameroonian government blames the war for a 15-30% increase in the price of staple food items, especially wheat, maize, sorghum and rice, widely consumed in areas along the northern border with Nigeria and Chad. Cameroon relies on Ukraine for 60% of its wheat imports. The war has caused the price of a 50-kilogram bag of wheat to climb from $35 to $60, an amount the government says a majority of the hungry people cannot afford. Ephraim Chi owns a maize plantation in Pus, a town on the border with Chad. He says unpredictable weather conditions and changing climate patterns make it difficult for farmers to know when to plant.
At times, we'll go for a long time without rains, and at times the rains will come intense. So farmers are now confused when to actually plant their crops. And that is why we have a lot of poor yields now. People are cutting a lot of trees, and these trees regulate the climate. When the soil is so dry, because we've cut down a lot of trees, the catchments dry up.
Chi blamed civilians for cutting down trees for firewood and logging companies for what he said is their attitude to destroy the environment. Cameroonian officials say more than 40,000 people, a majority of them cattle ranchers, farmers and fishers, are still planning to return to the border region despite fleeing December 2021 bloody clashes over water resources. The government has not said how much it needs to reduce the food crisis, but that it is in negotiations with funding agencies and friendly countries. Last week, Japan's government donated $1.2 million to the World Food Program to assist vulnerable persons, including those threatened by hunger in Cameroon, Chad, and the Central African Republic. In a food analysis back in April, the World Food Program said staple food prices, early depletion of household food stocks, and declining incomes from reduced crop sales limit food access for poor Cameroonian households amid low levels of humanitarian assistance. The report says the ongoing Boko Haram insurgency in northern Cameroon and clashes between government forces and separatist fighters in the northwest and southwest regions continue to negatively affect the livelihoods of populations and drive high numbers of acutely food insecure persons. The separatists are seeking to carve out an independent English-speaking region from the rest of the French-speaking country. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
Aid group Refugees International has expressed concern about the reported relocation of more than 100 Eritrean refugees from areas near Addis Ababa to camps on the unstable border between Ethiopia's Amhara and Tigray regions. Mohamed Yusuf reports from VOA's African News Center in Nairobi, Kenya.
Ethiopian authorities are accused of targeting Eritrean refugees by arresting them in the capital and sending them back to the country's restive north. Abdoulaye Haleke is a Refugees International Senior Advocate for East and Southern Africa.
Over the last few days, Eritrean refugees who have been living in Ethiopia for some time now, and so the government rounded up these refugees who are in Addis Ababa in several buses and took them back to the Amhara region. And as you well know, that the Amhara region and the Tigray region, they border each other and there is tension.
Amhara and Tigrayan forces have been fighting over land and other long-standing disputes. About 20,000 Eritrean refugees lived in two refugee camps in the Tigray region before the war between Ethiopia's government and Tigrayan rebels broke out in November 2020. After Eritrean and Tigrayan forces allegedly attacked the camps, many of the refugees fled to the Amhara and Afar regions, with others moving to the capital Addis Ababa. In late 2020, Ethiopian authorities carried out a similar operation targeting Eritrean refugees in the capital, sending them to Adi Harush and Mai Ani in the Tigray region at the height of the war. Haleke says in many ways, Eritrean refugees are the most vulnerable group in Ethiopia.
They are caught between Eritrean government tracking them because it paints a bad image about their country. And, you know, the warring parties inside Ethiopia also targeting them. As such, they are in probably the most difficult position. So death, sexual violence, and so many other egregious human rights and humanitarian violations have been visited upon them.
Last year, Human Rights Watch said Eritrean forces and Tigray militias committed killings, rape and other abuses against Eritrean refugees. Ethiopia hosts at least 140,000 Eritreans who fled hardship and persecution in their home country. Refugees International, an organization which promotes human rights and the protection of refugees, is calling on Ethiopian authorities to respect its laws and protect Eritrean refugees from those who wish to harm them. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight, live on the Voice of America. I'm Yeheyes Wuhib in Washington. Please note, we have moved our programs from voanews.com to voaafrica.com. There, you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. Find us on voaafrica.com. Every July 18th, the United Nations calls on the world to honor the late Nelson Mandela, the first president of a fully democratic South Africa and leader of the African National Congress, which fought for the end of South Africa's former apartheid regime. Today, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres said Mandela remains a moral compass for the world. Guterres said the world today struggles with war, emergencies, discrimination, and poverty. He called on people to follow Mandela's example and speak out against hate and support human rights. Linda Thomas Greenfield, the United States Ambassador to the United Nations, said people should honor the human rights leader by recognizing that everyone has the responsibility and power to make a difference in our communities. A new United Nations report says African countries must diversify exports if they are to survive economic shocks. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
A report by the United Nations Conference on Trade and Development, UNCTAD, calls on African countries to broaden their exports beyond commodities if they are to escape poverty. UNCTAD's Economic Development in Africa report for 2022 says that global crises, including the COVID-19 pandemic and Ukraine war, threaten African countries' economies. It says millions of Africans already struggle to make a living in the middle of a rapidly rising food and energy crisis. UN economists say Africa will not get out of its poverty trap if the continent remains dependent on exports of primary products, mainly in the agricultural, mining, and extractive industries. They note commodities still account for more than 60% of total merchandise exports in 45 of Africa's 54 countries. UNCTAD Secretary General Rebecca Greenspan says one out of two Africans, more than 600 million people, are severely vulnerable to food, energy, and finance shocks. She says Africa must diversify its economy to become more resilient.
The report makes clear the great potential for African countries to transform their economies through services, supporting the continent's long-standing economic diversification goals, boosting productivity and development.
UNCTAD says knowledge-intensive services such as information and communication technology, or ICT, and financial services could be a game-changer for Africa. However, they note the sector currently accounts for only 20% of the continent's services exports. Greenspan says traditional services such as travel and transport dominate, accounting for about two-thirds of the total services trade.
The analysis we're sharing today provides convincing evidence that high-value services, especially high-intensity ones in ICT and finance, are often the missing link that explain why diversification has not been achieved in the continent.
Greenspan says economic diversification should be a priority in Africa. She says it is the only path to sustainable growth and to high-quality jobs for young people. The UNCTAD report calls on African countries to implement policies to better link trade and high-value services with other sectors, especially manufacturing. It also calls for removal of protectionist measures that limit the development of high-value added services trade. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Managers of South Africa's National Electricity Corporation, Eskom, have promised an end to the long power outages hitting the country by the end of the week. But citizens and energy experts are skeptical. Blackouts lasting more than 8 hours a day have been plaguing South Africa for more than 3 weeks, costing the economy billions of dollars. Poor infrastructure and lack of maintenance, worsened by a decade of corruption and mismanagement at Eskom, and a recent strike, have left the country's electricity grid in danger of collapse. Darren Taylor reports.
When one of Eskom's 8 coal-fired power stations begins to fail, it has to ration electricity in a process it calls load shedding. It cuts electricity in stages from 1 to 8. The higher the stage, the longer the outage. South Africa's been on stage 6 load shedding for much of the past 3 weeks, meaning widespread and long blackouts. Eskom CEO André de Reiter told reporters this weekend a major reason for the outages has been the breakdown of generating units at one of the country's biggest power stations, Tutuka.
We've got a couple of big units returning, so that's positive news. But ultimately, to put load shedding to bed, what we need is additional capacity, because the system as it is at the moment is still unreliable and unpredictable. And we need to give colleagues like Salomo Mecha, the power station manager at Tutuka here, the headroom to carry out much-needed maintenance in order to make sure that Tutuka power station runs like the oiled machine it should.
But energy experts say there's nothing well-oiled about Eskom right now, with little chance of that lubrication happening any time soon.
I thought by this stage people would have learned that it's not wise to make predictions about ongoing or future load shedding.
Clyde Mallinson's an independent energy analyst.
So when you've been hovering around stage 6 or stage 4, it's a dramatic improvement to revert to stage 2. But stage 2 is not really acceptable. I don't think we're going to see an end to load shedding soon, unfortunately.
That kind of improvement is also not acceptable to the leader of the Economic Freedom Fighters Party, Julius Malema. He's organizing a national shutdown to protest any and all load shedding.
All offices of Eskom will be occupied to demand the resignation of the CEO, the resignation of the board, and to put in people who have got capacity to run that institution. We don't believe that Eskom has reached the stage of hopelessness. There are a lot of skilled and qualified people that can be recalled to come and save the day.
But Mallinson says Eskom's present leaders are doing their best to save a ship that began sinking during the 9 years that Jacob Zuma was president. A commission of inquiry has found that Zuma appointed cronies to loot Eskom, which the former president calls one big lie. Mallinson says the organized crime syndicates that flourished under Zuma at Eskom are still operating and are sabotaging power stations by feeding boilers poor quality coal.
And then if it's not getting fed properly, you have to inject oil into the boiler to make up for the low quality food. And of course, if you've got a scheme going on nicking some of that oil into trucks parked in Millie Field somewhere close to the power station in the middle of the night, then it's in your interest to make sure that the power station gets poor food, has to supplement the food with vitamins, and you then get yourself in between the vitamin supplier and the vitamin user, and you start selling vitamins to someone else.
Mallinson says he feels for Eskom management because it's fighting a war on multiple fronts, against a public that brands it useless, against politicians eager to fuel public outrage, and even against its own corrupt employees. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Two tribes in South Africa have been paid more than $700,000 as part of a benefit-sharing agreement. Vicky Stark reports from Cape Town.
The director of the SAN Council, Liana Snyders, says it took 9 years of negotiations and the Rooibos Traditional Knowledge Benefit Sharing Agreement was finally signed in November 2019. She says the indigenous tribes still use rooibos today, for example, when babies have teething problems. It is also used to treat skin conditions like eczema and to alleviate stomach cramps. Does she think similar agreements should be in place to benefit other indigenous people around the world?
I feel good because it was for a long time coming. We should have been paid a long time ago.
And she says indigenous people must be taught about the legal process.
Definitely, definitely. If, for instance, I'm a company, based on the people that lived in the area's knowledge, then I made a product, or I use the plant and I sell it and I make a profit as a company. So I would definitely recommend this type of collaborations with industry.
The first annual payment of $700,000 comes from a 1.5% levy on the sale of all rooibos that has been cut and dried. The money has been paid into two trust accounts for the SAN and the COI. So how will it be spent?
You must stand up for your rights. Because in our case, if we did not stand up 9 years ago, going to the government and say that we want our traditional knowledge to be recognized, if we did not make the first step as a SAN people, we will not be here where we are today.
A director of the South African Rooibos Council, Darby de Villiers, says he can't really give an accurate estimate of how much the industry is worth. He says, though, that the caffeine-free product is exported to over 50 countries, and the number grows every year.
In fact, it has some good medical studies that identify it as being a good product to use in stress alleviation. And, yeah, we're seeing it more and more being used in a wide range of applications, not only in herbal teas, but also in nutritional supplement formulations. So it is certainly a product for today's times.
Officials say this is being regarded as the pilot phase of the agreement, and further negotiations will take place to develop a non-monetary benefit-sharing model. Vicky Stark for VOA News, Cape Town, South Africa.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiyes Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, and our engineer, John Dryden, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.